From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start this week with our monthly tour of science headlines, compliments of our friends at the journal Nature. Joining me on the line from London is senior physics reporter Lizzie Gibney. Lizzie, good to talk with you again.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
So Huawei, the Chinese tech company, has been in the news a lot lately, facing federal criminal charges of intellectual property theft. And now we're hearing that some academic institutions, notably UC Berkeley, rethinking relationships with Huawei. What kinds of relationships have they had?
Well, they've had various kinds of research relationships. So Huawei might be part of a collaboration, so they're giving some funding to the institution, or they have a general collaboration between academics at the company and at the university. Huawei have been investing loads more in recent years. So I think in 2017, they said that they invested about $13 billion around the world in R&D. And
Wow.
They're really ramping up the amount. Yeah, it's a lot. And they're giving a lot of that to universities. So we looked at the number of academic papers that were published with money from Huawei, and it's absolutely boomed. It went up from under about 100 in 2015 to more than 600 last year. So there really has been a rise in terms of the amount of funding that they're putting into academic research.
Well, and as I noted, UC Berkeley is saying that they're going to not take any more funding from Huawei. A couple of other institutions have said, yeah, we're rethinking, looking at our relationships and rethinking it. I mean, how big a shift could this be?
It could be a pretty big shift. As I said, the numbers that we're talking about is today pretty huge. They're not scrapping any existing collaboration. So if there's a research project that's ongoing, that's going to stay. But what they're not going to do is enter into any new research partnerships. At the moment, we know of UC Berkeley, Oxford in the UK, and the University of Texas at Austin is reviewing their relationship. But there are many institutions across the states who could follow suit. We're talking about a suspension at the moment. This all depends on what happens with those criminal charges. And of course, we should say that the company Huawei denies any wrongdoing in this case.
Shifting tracks a little bit, federal officials are considering changes to Title IX regulations that govern how colleges and universities handle gender discrimination and sexual harassment. Scientists have been really vocal in the public comment period that just closed. What did they have to say?
Absolutely. Well, Title IX is the primary legal weapon for fighting sexual harassment in US academia. And of course, academia is a sector that has a real problem when it comes to harassment. I think studies have shown that it's second only to the military in that aspect. So Title IX has become really important. As you mentioned, there have been a lot of public comments, 103,000 in 60 days. That's pretty unprecedented. And generally, not across the board, but generally, there has been a lot of concern expressed, some dismay at the changes to Title IX, because people are worried that the redefinitions included in it might effectively water down the legislation, make it harder for people to bring cases of sexual harassment, and to generally make it a more hostile environment for the victims.
Do you have a sense among these comments, is it primarily individual scientists or is it, heads of professional organizations, institutions, kind of larger organizational objection to this policy shift?
It's both, actually. There were a lot of comments from individuals, from students, from people who were victims themselves. So a lot of the comments were very heartfelt, actually, and quite, upsetting to read. But it was also universities themselves at a senior level. And to some extent, the changes in the regulations would ease the burden on them. And that is one of the reasons why the administration says that they want to bring about the changes. They say it's redressing the balance more in favour of the person who's accused and bringing the burden away from the universities. But actually, the universities themselves, in many cases, are saying, we don't want this change. It might make it harder for us to bring those sexual harassment cases that we actually want to and to sort out this problem.
Well, that public comment period has closed, so I guess we've probably got a few months to wait and hear what the response from the government will be and what that policy might actually look like. Lizzie Gibney, you're a physics reporter. Let's jump to something a little bit more in your wheelhouse, specifically a really interesting piece in Nature recently on how machine learning, artificial intelligence, could actually help prevent bioterrorism. connect the dots there for us.
That's right. So at the moment, it's quite routine for biologists to pay companies to make little snippets of DNA. That's become really cheap and easy nowadays. They say it's like pennies per base. And a problem with that is that people worry that bioterrorists might effectively synthesize some pathogen. Now, screening does already exist to make sure that companies are not making these dangerous toxins or viruses. But the problem is that in theory, it's very possible to change just a few bases within that sequence. So the sequence no longer matches the original, and maybe it's not therefore picked up by the screening process. But crucially, it still remains dangerous. So what this project is trying to do is use machine learning, the artificial intelligence technique that searches through many, many examples to try and find commonalities, to find patterns that maybe humans themselves wouldn't spot. So what they're hoping to be able to do with machine learning is by studying lots and lots of these sequences to figure out what it is that is the dangerous part of the sequence. So that means that in the future, rather than effectively matching your sequence with, you know, a big file that you have of existing pathogens, you're saying, is this sequence, does it contain something that would be dangerous? And that's really, really powerful. It means you can then look at perhaps newly synthesized toxins and find what might be dangerous within that.
Lizzie, this month is widely recognized as the 150th anniversary of the Periodic Table of Elements, and Nature actually ran an editorial calling for celebrations of the periodic table's birthday, in essence, which is kind of interesting because the periodic table itself is not a discovery per se. It's an organizational system for putting chemicals into some sort of organization, into some sort of order. What's so important and influential about the periodic table?
Well, perhaps I'm biased, but I think it's just absolutely smart and beautiful the way in which it's done and so useful. So, you know, the idea of a periodic table is pretty simple. You know, you line up all of the elements according to their atomic number, which we now know is the number of protons in their nucleus. And this pattern emerges, which is to do with the fact that as you go along, you are adding electrons and they fill up shells and then you start a new shell. And how many electrons in its shell that an element has in its shell relates to its chemical properties. So essentially you build up this picture that shows you the commonalities between the elements and they then sit in columns. You know, you might remember from high school days that fluorine and bromine and chlorine will all behave alike because they all sit in that same column, which we call a group in the periodic table. So it's an incredibly useful device. And I think that was shown by the fact that, so when it was Dmitry Mendeleev who invented this way of organising it, and he actually put together these columns that relate to the properties, he left gaps because he realised that there must be missing elements. And then along the way, over the course of history, they were of course filled in. So that shows you the real power of looking at patterns and devising the structure in this way.
Lizzie Gibney is a senior physics reporter at Nature. Thanks so much, Lizzie.
Thank you.
In other recent news, President Trump's second State of the Union address included the word science, not just once, but twice. The president called for efforts to stop the spread of HIV and cure childhood cancers, but climate change was nowhere to be found. Jamie Vernon is executive director and CEO of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Honor Society, and publisher of American Scientist. He was once again watching the State of the Union for clues about the president's attitude towards science. Jamie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You were watching not just for keywords like science or discovery, but for, you know, content and statements that actually reflect a respect for and a commitment to science. What stood out to you?
Yeah, this was an interesting speech. And, you know, you have to separate in many ways what was presented in the State of the Union from actually some of the actions and policies of the administration. But just looking at this particular State of the Union address, they really accomplished what I call the trifecta of science. Trump really covered the impact of science on economics, as well as health, and even defense and national security. So he was able to integrate that throughout his speech when he was working through various areas that he cared about. And I think that that was a nice, you know, message to those of us in the scientific community that even within this administration and some of their questionable policies, particularly around climate change, he still had demonstrated a great appreciation for science.
I think there's some skepticism about how genuine that respect is, though. And if we take in particular some of the initiatives that he announced with regard to childhood cancer and HIV transmission, I mean, biomedical science in general tends to have bipartisan support. It was some of the only science not disrupted by the shutdown because the National Institutes of Health were funded last fall as part of a spending package. Putting that front and center, is that just kind of a safe token way to say, yeah, hey, science? Or do you feel that those are genuine, significant commitments?
There does need to be some skepticism, particularly, you know, one of the areas that President Trump highlighted was his focus on HIV, which many might find ironic given that he disbanded essentially his HIV or AIDS advisors last year. And so it is questionable as to whether or not he's going to be able to execute on that. I don't think that there will be much skepticism about America's commitment and the government's commitment to pursuing cures for childhood cancer. But I do have to think, you know, what are the policies that are going to back up his commitment to eliminating HIV epidemic in 10 years, which is what he said. I think a lot of people walked away from that with a big question of how. And it has echoes to the Nixon administration, which in 1971, during the State of the Union, said they were committing $100 million to fight cancer. And as you know, that's an ongoing fight.
Of course. And then, of course, there's the fact that climate change and climate science was absolutely nowhere in this State of the Union. And that's been the focus of a lot of the concern from the scientific community about this administration's attitude towards science. Where does that fit into your assessment of at least what this State of the Union says about the administration's attitude towards science?
Well, it's disappointing that climate change, which I believe is the ultimate challenge for science in modern times, was not covered at all in the State of the Union. It is worth mentioning that the Democratic response from Stacey Abrams did touch on the climate change issue, but the State of the Union, for the most part, ignored this as an issue that the country's facing. In fact, President Trump focused on the advancements that have occurred in the energy space and how the United States has become more energy independent.
And for that matter, how much of a leading producer of fossil fuels that cause climate change the United States has been, actually bragging about that.
Exactly. I think that that's a dangerous conversation for any president to ignore the science that's pushing back on our advancement in fossil fuels. And my overall assessment of the speech was that when you read it as a standalone, it's supportive of science, but this is a major area that's troubling.
Well, and as you say, if you read it as a standalone, and you said at the beginning of our conversation, you know, we should take this State of the Union address as its own thing, separate from the rest of the administration's policies. Mm-hmm. But should we? I mean, this is one speech. How much weight should we be giving that versus almost 2 years' worth of policy decisions?
To me, in the scientific community, we talk about building a relationship with the public and maintaining trust and understanding that trusted voices in our communities can build trust in science when they're communicating the value and contributions of science to the public. And when even this president, who we know is pushing some policies that may not necessarily work in the best interest of science, he is signaling to his followers, his base supporters, that science has made major contributions to this country. And for that reason, I think we should have some hope. There were highlights. He highlighted the Apollo 11 mission. He talked about the transformation that science has made and the contributions to quality of life. We have to at least acknowledge that he's not dismissing science writ large, and the concept of war on science may not hold up here.
Jamie Vernon is Executive Director and CEO at Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Honor Society, and publisher of American Scientist. Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Up next, what would it take to get off fossil fuels before mid-century? Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate science may have been absent from President Trump's second State of the Union address, but it was all over Capitol Hill on Wednesday, with two House committees holding climate change hearings. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker was among those called to testify. He highlighted the Commonwealth's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Massachusetts' 2008 Global Warming Solutions Act is one of the most ambitious state climate policies, mandates dramatic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Now proposed legislation sets an even more ambitious goal for the state, 100% renewable energy by 2045. And federal Green New Deal legislation unveiled this past week also aims for 100% renewable energy, possibly as soon as 2030. Putting aside for the moment the political hurdles these plans might face, there are technical questions here. Do we have what we need to get off fossil fuels, and how long would it take? Mark Z. Jacobson of Stanford University and the Solutions Project has tackled those questions, and not only for the United States. He and several colleagues last year published roadmaps to 100% renewable energy for 139 nations around the world. Mark, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Before we dive into how we get to 100% renewable energy, we maybe need to define what renewable energy is. Different people seem to have different definitions. So what do you consider in your roadmaps?
Well, we call it clean renewable energy. So those are wind, water, and solar power. So onshore and offshore wind, solar photovoltaics on rooftops and in power plants, concentrated solar power, geothermal power, tidal and wave power, and existing hydroelectric power. But we don't propose new hydroelectric. So we do not include biofuels because it's still you still burn biofuels and they create a huge amount of pollution. And they also use a huge amount of land and water. And we're trying to solve the air pollution problems as well as climate problems simultaneously. And we don't include coal with carbon capture, partly because it hardly exists at any commercial scale. It hardly reduces any carbon. It increases air pollution relative to coal without carbon capture. Same with natural gas with carbon capture. And we don't include nuclear power, partly because of the fact that it takes so long, between 10 and 19 years between planning and operation, that it just won't even help to solve the problem. It costs about five times more than wind power or solar power right now per unit energy. And it has all these other risks associated with it, including meltdown risk, weapons proliferation risk. There's no solution to the waste problem. There's also miners dying of lung cancer because they have to mine it. And you also have some carbon emissions, about 9 to 25 times more carbon emissions per unit energy than wind power due to the continuous mining and refining of uranium during the lifetime of a nuclear plant, and the fact that it takes so long to put up that while you're waiting around for it to put up, you're burning coal and gas in the regular grid, and that has to count against nuclear because you don't have the same impacts with when you put up wind and solar, which can go up anywhere from 1 to 5 years.
Well, Mark Jacobson, the roadmaps that you have created, at least at the national level, are aiming for 80% renewable by 2030, 100% renewable by 2050. And you've done this for cities, states, and 139 different countries.
Correct.
Let's focus on the U.S. first and foremost. What does the U.S. roadmap look like?
Well, like most of the roadmaps, it's primarily solar and wind. So, I mean, each state, we actually did plans for each of the United States. And so each state would be a little bit different. But on average, it's mostly solar, about over 50%, maybe 55 to 58% solar, about 38% wind. And then there's existing hydroelectric power. And when you look at the totals among all energy sectors, it's about 4% hydroelectric. And then there's small amounts of geothermal and even lesser amounts of tidal and wave power. And we also need storage, too. So it's not just adding electricity, because we'll need electricity storage, heat storage, cold storage, and some hydrogen for transportation, where the hydrogen is produced from electricity. And we also then need battery electric vehicles using heat pumps. But I should say, you know, this transition, most people don't realize it, but you would actually reduce power demand without anybody changing their habits by about 59% by electrifying everything and providing that electricity with clean renewable energy. And I can break that down.
Yeah. How does that actually work?
Well,
how does just changing the source of the electricity reduce the need for electricity?
Yeah, it's interesting. But it's, well, first of all, about 13% of all energy worldwide is used to mine, transport, refine, process fossil fuels and uranium. So by eliminating the needs for those fuels, we actually just eliminate right away 13% of all energy. I mean, because wind comes right to the turbine, solar comes right to the panel, we don't need to dig it up like we do with these other fuels.
We do have to, though, dig up things like the metals that go into creating the wind turbines and the solar panels, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. But keep in mind that the fossil fuels we're mining every moment, every minute, every day because we have to continuously supply new fossil fuels. So it's just orders and orders of magnitude more energy required to do that. In the United States, every year, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled. And we would need to do that every year forever to keep this going. And we just know that's not going to happen because the oil and gas industry, well, and the coal industry take up 1.3% of the U.S. land area already. And so, you know, it's going to have to stop at some point.
And yet one of the concerns about both wind and solar is the amount of space that they might take up. I mean, if we're getting, you know, almost 60% of our energy from solar, almost 40% from wind, how much of U.S. landmass does that require?
Yeah, it's much less than that of the fossil fuel industry, for sure. It's, as I mentioned, 1.3% of U.S. land is dedicated to the fossil fuel infrastructure. And if we transition everything to 100% renewables, it would be about 0.7% for the wind, water, solar infrastructure.
Mark Jacobson, the roadmaps that you have created at these various different scales, I wonder kind of what goes into creating one of these roadmaps, and is this the only possible route, or to use the map analogy, is there an alternative, or are there multiple alternative routes that we could pursue to get to the end goal of 100% renewable power?
There are not that many alternatives. There are, I mean, we've looked at all the proposed options, and the ones that we've excluded are just not that good, and they don't help, or they help very slowly over a long period of time. But that means they're an opportunity cost. I mean, to give you an example, for example, Poland, they just proposed putting up a nuclear plant, but they acknowledge that it won't, today they're planning it, it will not be ready until one plant, just one, won't be ready until the year 2033. So that's 14 years from now. By then, we need 80% reduction already by 2030, and their first plant won't even be up till 2033. And the cost of that will be five times as much as if we spent that money on wind power. So why not just take that money, spend it on wind power today? You'll have wind going within 1 to 5 years, and we can start solving the problem. You know, now the possibilities are limitless. I mean, there's no barrier to just solving this problem by this enormous expansion offshore, especially, but also onshore of utility solar and wind. You know, the biggest problem with the wind renewables is they're intermittent, but you actually reduce that intermittency by interconnecting geographically dispersed wind and solar, because even though one wind turbine is intermittent, when you connect wind turbines over several hundred kilometers by transmission, then you actually convert something that's completely intermittent or variable or random into something that's 33 to 47% completely reliable. So it's, and then plus you have storage on top of that, you have existing hydroelectric that you can use to fill in gaps of supply, and you have electric vehicles that a lot of your power demand is now going to cars, which you don't need the electricity right away. You can charge a car at night. So there are a lot of what are called flexible loads in this new system that you don't need electricity right away. So it's easier to match power demand with supply on the grid.
I mean, you say there's no barrier to making this transition. And yet we hear constantly about barriers to making this transition, whether it's the cost or the lack of technology. There must be some difficulty in making this transition, or else we already would have made it.
There are no technical or economic barriers, I should say. There are social and political barriers. Those are the barriers. In terms of technologies, we have almost everything we need. There's really, the only things that we don't have are for long-distance jets and long-distance ships. We need to convert those to hydrogen fuel cell and electric combinations. There are companies building short-distance aircraft that can, commercial aircraft that can seat 50 to 100 people over 1,500 kilometers. And that's about half the airline mileage. And there are short-distance ships being built that are electric. There are certain things that haven't been built to any scale, but those represent, I would say, less than about 5 to 10% of the total emission so far. And there are ways to build those things that just haven't been built. And that's why we leave the last 20% between 2030 and 2050, and 80% before that, for the more difficult things to actually implement commercially. But we don't think that's a barrier.
So let's talk about that timing, because a number of the plans that we've seen coming out in recent weeks have actually set much more ambitious goals, 100% renewable by 2030, even 2035. I mean, how much of a difference does 5, 10, 15 years make when we're trying to make this really dramatic transition in so many parts of our infrastructure. Is something like 100% renewable by 2030 even possible?
Well, I think we need to clarify, because a lot of these plans, they're just looking at the electricity sector, and a lot of the plans are just are state plans. So for state plan looking at the electricity sector, we can actually get to 100% by 2030 or 2035. The cost right now, the cost is very low because wind is the cheapest form. Wind and utility scale solar are the cheapest forms of electricity in the United States today. And they cost about half the cost of natural gas right now, or maybe two thirds to half the cost. And so the reason it hasn't transformed so far is because we do have an existing infrastructure and there's no incentive, well, there's little incentive for the existing players to just disappear. You know, each year you're only naturally retiring, you know, let's say 1/30th of the infrastructure. So at that pace, you'd take 30 years to replace everything, even if we had 100% new stuff every year. Good policies, strong policies in place can help this transition faster. If we just let it on its own without policies, there will be a transition, but it'll be a slow transition. The key is to not build anything new with gas, no new gasoline cars, diesel trucks. Electrify everything, provide that electricity with clean renewable energy, use heat pumps for all heating of air and water and air conditioning and refrigeration. Use electric vehicles, some hydrogen fuel cell for long distance, and provide the electricity with wind and water and solar. And then high temperature processes use a lot of existing electric technologies to get high temperatures. And that's basically how you solve the problem.
That's a recipe for 100% renewable energy from Mark Z. Jacobson. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and co-founder of the Solutions Project and 100.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Firefighting foams, nonstick pots and pans, stain-resistant furniture. If you stop and think about it for a minute, they kind of sound like inventions of the Jetsons. The chemicals that give these items their nearly magical properties are known as PFAS, perfluoroalkyl substances. They're persistent, they're widely used, and the problem is they may also be bad for our health. And they're not staying where we put them, in our clothes and cookware. These chemicals have also been found in drinking water supplies around the country and in the vast majority of people's bodies. Over the past year, federal officials have been holding community meetings and gathering comments as they consider setting legal drinking water limits for PFAS. Several states have also set limits or started moving in that direction. I'm joined now by Rainer Lohmann. He's a professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island and director of a multi-institute Superfund research center focusing on these chemicals. Rainer, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
My pleasure being here.
Help us get to know what's behind this acronym PFAS, sometimes called, is it PFAS or PFAS?
PFASs. Those are basically chemicals that have a carbon backbone, just like everything that is in living human beings. And then they have most of the hydrogens replaced by fluorine, which gives these chemicals these wonderful properties that we treasure in daily life, but also makes them extremely persistent so they don't break down easily and unfortunately also leads then to health problems and so on.
There are two out of the, 3,000 plus PFAS chemicals. There are two in particular that tend to get a lot of attention, PFOS, PFOS, and PFOA, PFOA. Why those two in particular?
They were major manufacturing chemicals, so they were the main mainly used for the production of Teflon, among other polymers, and then used in firefighting foams and all kinds of surface treatments. And of course, they have the right properties to be successful in the market, but also they don't break down. And we now know that there are severe health effects coming out of an exposure to these chemicals.
What kinds of health effects and what is the evidence there?
So if you live near one of the production facilities, and we know this now through one of the biggest epidemiological studies ever, I believe, where over 70,000 people participated. And so long-term exposure to these chemicals has been linked to different cancers, among others. So it's serious.
What types of cancer are we talking about? And how strong is the evidence? I mean, are we talking a few studies, dozens of studies, animal models, human studies?
So there's a wide range of studies. The most famous ones are what's called the C8 panel that was established after DuPont was successfully sued. And there was an agreement reached by DuPont and the plaintiffs to accept the verdict of three independent scientists who would look at 70,000 records and exposure over time and figure out what is a probable link. And kidney cancer was one of them. Testicular cancer was one of them. There was several others. And that's the high-end exposure. For the continuous low-dose exposure that you and I probably have, there's evidence coming both from animal studies, of course, but also from other epidemiological studies. The best ones I'm aware of are also linked to work in my center with children on the Faroe Islands. And if you have more of these chemicals in your blood, or children have, then their immune system gets compromised. And the evidence is that they don't respond to vaccines the way they should. There are other links to obesity and high cholesterol levels.
So a pretty wide array of potential health effects. Rainer Lohmann, you've testified before Congress about the need for stricter controls on potentially harmful chemicals in our lives. In your professional opinion, is the evidence regarding the health effects of PFAS chemicals, particularly, as you were saying, at the low levels that most of us are exposed to them, is the evidence there to start setting drinking water limits?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that exposure leads to negative effects on humans. I think that much we know. I think what EPA had to grapple with is whether they think this is a national problem or rather a localized regional problems. And presumably this decision against regulating them at the national level, they think it's not a national problem.
I mean, as you're saying, the EPA currently has what's called a health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion for these chemicals all combined. But that's not a legally enforceable limit. It doesn't mean that you know, water systems, for example, have to be monitoring for it. And it is a combined limit. And Politico, at least, has reported, EPA has not completed their entire process, but Politico, at least, has reported that the EPA is likely to decline to set specific limits for those two chemicals that we were talking about, the PFAS and the PFOA. How important is it to go from this advisory limit to a legally enforceable drinking water limit?
Oh, it makes a huge difference to exposure and treatment of these chemicals is going to happen, because if you don't make it mandatory to measure, you don't know who is exposed and you can't really effectively lower those exposures. But Politico has just reported that this is what might happen. I hope EPA will indeed regulate at least those two, but there's thousands of them. So PFOA and PFOS are two of the worst, but they're certainly the tip of the iceberg.
In a different case, Massachusetts has kind of gone a different direction, and the State Department of Environmental Protection has recently said that it won't set a drinking water limit for the entire class of chemicals, but it will for five specific ones, including PFAS and PFOA. Is this a case where maybe setting limits for some of the most common ones would essentially limit the whole class of chemicals?
I mean, I certainly applaud MassDEP for moving ahead with probably setting maximum contaminant levels for those five. But the problem is, it's, and I think in my field, you would call this the whack-a-mole approach. So you ban first PFOA and PFOS. And of course, as long as we still want to have our Teflon cookware and all the other applications, then you industry comes up with a different chemistry that has the same properties, but unfortunately also means it has somewhat similar toxicological profile. So now you have compounds that are either a little shorter or a little longer, slightly twisted, but have similar persistence in the environment. So the exposure will be similar.
So do you think that, in fact, setting a limit for the entire class of chemicals would be the more scientifically justified policy for these?
I think it would make a much better precautionary approach to dealing with chemicals that are extremely long-lived and possess properties that seem detrimental to the ecology and human health. I'm not going to pretend that it's going to be easy to regulate the whole class, but it's the only comprehensive approach that really makes it for certain that we're not going to continue to be exposed for slightly different tweaks of the same class of chemicals.
Rainer Lohmann, before actually setting a limit, Massachusetts officials have said they're going to do some water testing. I mean, whether or not my well or my town's water were to test high or over a limit or over an advisory level, the evidence to date suggests that most of us have these chemicals already in our bodies. What do we do to try to reduce our own exposures as we're waiting for these government processes to work their way through potentially to drinking water limits?
Well, let me first make a case in support of EPA, because EPA phased out the production of PFOA and PFOS already years ago. So when they realized the problems that were looming, they worked with the manufacturers to phase them out. And you see the results slowly in human blood data from across the U.S. Concentrations of PFOA and PFOS are slowly decreasing, so that's a good sign. However, not a big surprise, other chemicals that are slightly longer or shorter are slowly creeping up. So as I said, it's this whack-a-mole approach. You ban one, you get another one instead. What you can do to reduce your own exposure is a question we've been grappling with a lot as part of our center, and certainly making sure you know what's in your water helps. Other uses where you might have them in your home is anything that is non-stick, be that the treated carpet, the fabrics. There was an exposure pathway that might not be as relevant. That was microwavable popcorn. There's all kinds of grease-proof containers like pizza boxes that had those chemicals or have them. But so there are some things you can try to avoid.
Rainer Lohmann is a professor of oceanography at University of Rhode Island, and he leads a multi-institute Superfund research center focusing on PFAS. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, new research suggests that social media use may not be as much of a problem for teens as we've thought. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. How much screen time is too much? Is social media connecting us or driving us into isolation and depression? These are questions that many of us now wrestle with on a frequent basis. That's especially true for parents of young children and teens who've been inundated with dire messages about the negative impacts of time spent online. A recent study in the journal Nature Human Behavior suggests that that concern may be overblown, that social media's negative impact on well-being is actually relatively small. Now, that's one study, but it's based on a lot of data and asked a lot of different questions. To understand what it might mean, we turn to lead author Amy Orban. She's a college lecturer in experimental psychology at Oxford University. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You are certainly not the first to ask and investigate whether social media has a negative impact on teens' well-being. What did you see missing from the existing body of evidence?
I think mainly that the body of evidence is extremely conflicting, and one day you might read something that screen time is really inherently bad and catastrophic for teen mental health, or on the other day you might read or listen to something that says, oh, it's actually not that bad, or it's actually positive. And as a researcher in the area, I was seeing all this conflicting evidence coming out, and what the work really tries to do is to figure out why we're not getting any clear answers. Partly it's due to how we analyze our data, partly it's due to how we interpret it, and also kind of what questions we asked. And so for me, I'm a very kind of analytical researcher. I do a lot of programming. It was a really great way to take all this data that we have available and have a look why we're not getting the clear answers we really need to understand how children are affected by digital technologies.
What specifically did you do differently to try to address the root causes of that debate as opposed to just being one more voice, one more study in that debate?
A lot of the studies that have been referenced in this debate use openly available data sets. So as a researcher, I can actually go online and I can download them. And so I, instead of using just one data set, I've used three, both in the UK and the US.
And what kind of data are we talking about?
So this is data from over 300,000 adolescents. So they note down how good they're feeling and also how much of various digital technologies they're using. And this is kind of completely cross-sectional. So naturally, we are looking at them at one time point. So it's really hard to say what causes what. But we have this data, and oftentimes, and this is how I felt before I started this kind of in-depth research, we think of analyzing the data almost like a tool to see what the data is showing us. So kind of like a magnifying glass that we hold to the data and we see what's going on. But actually what researchers have been showing for the last years is that data analysis is a lot more powerful, and actually how we analyze the data can change what we see in the data sets we're looking at. And this is because researchers need to take huge amounts of decisions to even answer a very simple question, like what is the correlation between digital technologies and well-being? And what decisions they take can be biased by what they think they should be finding in the data set. And so these kind of unconscious or conscious biases lead them to analyze the data in specific ways, and that can really bias what the end result is. So kind of the long story short is that what I tried to do is I would simulate that, for example, we have 1,000 different research groups, all with subtly different biases, and they all look at the same data set with the same research question. And what I showed is that they can actually find loads of different results.
That's pretty concerning on its own, that different researchers potentially using the same data in different ways would find such different results. How do you then get past that?
Naturally, it's concerning, and we're currently going through a replication crisis in psychology that, as psychologists, we're really thinking about, you know, what is holding our science back? And this is part of what is holding our science back, that we can bias our results by analyzing our data flexibly. There are easy ways, actually, to safeguard ourselves as researchers against this. Part of it is to be extremely transparent, to share your code online, or to note down how you will analyze the data before you actually look at the data, because then your unconscious or conscious biases can influence what actual decisions you take. So these are actually quite simple safeguarding mechanisms we can put into place. And there is a real group of researchers now who are shouting out that this is what we need to do more broadly in the sciences.
So, Amy Orban, in the work that you did, you mentioned you had these three different data sets, and you tried to probe it in a whole lot of different ways. And in the end, you concluded that social media does have a negative relationship with teen well-being, but that it's very small. It accounts for something like 0.4% of differences in teen well-being. Were you surprised by that result?
Yes, I often, as a researcher, I feel like I live in two completely differing worlds. So I live in the world where I listen to the radio and I watch TV and I read the newspaper and talk to other people on the street, and people are really concerned about social media. And on the other side, I live in the world where I work with this data on a daily basis, and I keep on finding that the effects aren't as severely negative as we would definitely expect it to be from the amount of public conversation we're having. So it was definitely surprising as such. Now that I look at it, you know, I've been working on this for now 1.5 years. I do see that there are reasons why we're not finding these intense negative effects that have been proclaimed in the last years.
And what are those reasons?
I think, firstly, we are asking the wrong research questions. So the question that I asked in the study and that multiple researchers have asked across the world is, does digital technology use affect adolescent well-being? I often liken this to asking, does eating sugar affect well-being? If we were a group of scientists trying to figure this out, we would probably quickly realize that we need to add more nuance into that research question to actually get some sort of actionable result, because the effect of eating sugar really depends on the person. So if we're talking about diabetics, the effect could be horrendous. But if we're talking about ultramarathon runners, it might be a huge boost to their performance. And also, we need to think about what sorts of amounts and kinds of sugars we're talking about. Are we talking about a granola bar after a PE lesson for a child? Or are we talking about a piece of chocolate cake every hour? And only if we take that into account will we start getting some sort of concrete and consistent results. And this is the same with digital technology use. We need to start thinking about what sorts of digital technologies are children using, and also the individual differences that makes each adolescent unique. So I would expect that there are probably adolescents that are negatively affected by digital technologies, and there are some that are positively affected. And the same, there might be some digital technologies that have a negative effect, or some sorts of uses that have negative effects, and some that have positive. And so by asking these general questions, like, does digital technologies overall have a positive or a negative effect on adolescent well-being, we're averaging all this complexity. And so we're only finding very small negative effects. But that doesn't mean that there isn't that complexity. And I think what this work shows is that researchers really need to take that into account. And also parents and policymakers, that each digital technology isn't the same. They're all unique, and each adolescent is unique, and probably they're all affected differently by their use and by what they actually use.
Amy Orban, in the work that you've just published, you looked at a huge number of other factors that could influence teen well-being, not just their digital technology use. So what are some of the factors that seem to have a bigger influence on well-being, and is it possible that they're in some way connected to digital technology use?
In the work, I conclude by trying to really visualize almost how small these effects are. And so in the work, I looked at other variables that had been measured and their kind of correlation with well-being. And so I found something that has been kind of backed up by previous work, that things like getting a good breakfast before school, getting enough sleep, having a supportive environment where you grow up in have hugely positive effects. And the negative effect of digital technology use is incredibly small. It's dwarfed compared to how big these other effects are. And naturally, things like bullying, taking drugs have much bigger negative correlations.
Isn't it possible, though, that digital technology use is part of, say, not getting enough sleep or being distracted at home, not being involved in conversations at the dinner table, that somehow digital technology use and these more traditional factors that go into well-being, that they're actually intertwined at this point?
So those conjectures are really complex hypotheses and models that we're building now and that we want to test. I guess what's important to say is that at the moment we can't say. So the evidence can't actually put digital technologies into the complex context of digital childhood and childhood in general. And so this is where more research is taking place at the moment.
Amy Orban, obviously looking at the big averages is important, but it's also for parents trying to make a decision for their teen, for teens trying to make decisions for themselves, it's important at some point to get down to those individual cases, the ultramarathoner versus the diabetic, to use your analogy. How do we start to get there? And what advice would you give to parents at this point when it comes to screen time?
Yeah, I think what is crucial to say to parents now is that the scientific evidence is just not there yet, in that technological revolutions are coming at an incredibly accelerating pace, and we as scientists need to change our system to make sure we keep up with them. And that hasn't really worked in social media research, and we're still at the very beginning in trying to figure this out and trying to dissociate different types of adolescents. And this is some really interesting work that is going on, but it's really all ongoing. And if you do read these very scary links in the press, or if you hear it on the street, then oftentimes that's not backed up by the necessary evidence. That doesn't mean that I'm saying you shouldn't be setting limits or you shouldn't be worried if your teen is negatively affected. It's saying that at the moment we need to put that decision of how a teenager interacts with screens and how a child interacts with screens on the parents, because screen time is diverse and children is diverse. So we should empower parents to do what parents do best, and that is to weigh up pros and cons depending specifically on their child, with their child at the heart of the decision making, and then to make that decision. And I know that this isn't kind of an easy answer, and I know that puts a lot of pressure on parents, but it is better than saying we have the evidence when we don't have it.
Amy Orban of Oxford University, lead author of a recent study showing that social media's negative impact on teen well-being is smaller than widely thought. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. In the meantime, you can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.